Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I have the pleasure of sitting here with David Rosenfeld, who, wow, we've been together for how many years has it been?
2002, 17 years.
So virtually every book.
Yes, I was 12 when I started writing.
You were yes. Just a child from California who came over here being led by your large golden retriever.
Exactly.
And at that time, when we first started, you were living in California, and part of your life was, in fact, rescuing golden retrievers.
A major part of my life.
And still is.
Yes, it's different now. In California, we would rescue them and place them in homes and only bring home the ones that were too old or ill to be wanted by anybody. Now we only do the latter. Now shelters, we're in Maine now, and shelters call us when they want us to, when they have a dog they can't place for one of those reasons. So we take those dogs.
If I remember right, you drove over here and you would often get a dog or two here in Arizona and take it back to California with you.
Yes. One time I got two 12-year-old Goldens that were brothers and lived for 3 years with us.
So it was always exciting to
yes.
have you come and go. And we still have dogs that come to your events. And once or twice, in fact, as a corollary to your event, we've had to hire an exterminator to come in and remove the fleas.
Welcome to my world.
I'm sure. Yeah. But anyway, you had a memorable trip about the logistics of moving you, your wife, and all your dogs from California to Maine.
Yes, it was called dog tripping. And it was 25 dogs on 3 RVs and 11 humans.
And it was like a D-Day. I mean, you had all the precision there of Eisenhower organizing the
landing. It actually went very well. I hated every single second of it. But everybody else, all the other humans and the dogs, all loved it. They think it was the greatest adventure of their life.
And you got a great book out of it.
I got a book out of it.
It was a wonderful book. It was fun to read, and it did very well.
It did very well. Actually, it did very well. Not only did it do well, but because it was nonfiction, it opened me up to different readers. So all of my fiction books have done at least 30% better than any book before that. And I have to admit, I have to assume it's because of that.
I think it probably was. There was a shift, I can't remember where you started putting, or you didn't personally, but your publisher started putting pictures of dogs on the covers of your legal thrillers, at first blush seems kind of odd, but actually works really well.
In the sixth, the main character is a dog lover, but in the sixth book, there was a dog that was sort of integral to the plot. They found a dog that was supposed to have been missing with its murdered owner, and the dog being found triggers the case. So they put a golden retriever on the cover, and it sold twice as many copies as any previous book. So now, no matter what I write, there's going to be a dog on a cover.
Well, I really like the cover for Bark of Night, your new book, whom I assume is Truman, the adorable little dog who's kind of the trigger for this story.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, we had a choice about which book to feature on our website this week, and it was like Bark of Night hands down.
Exactly.
Because Truman is so
exactly.
irresistible.
And sometimes the cover has nothing to do with the book. I'm like, don't you put puppies on the cover? You know, just.
I think your Christmas book, if I remember, didn't they have puppies gambling in red plaid or something?
Yep.
Yeah. Which is great. So you've always said that writing these books was actually quite a fast project for you. Is that because you had training as a screenwriter, scriptwriter?
No, actually the opposite is true. It's because I never had writing. I think it's because I never trained to be a writer. I was a movie executive my whole life.
Oh, that's right. You weren't actually a screenwriter.
Well,
you
became a screenwriter after being an executive. I was a mediocre screenwriter. But the reason I'm fast is because I think it's because I never like learned to be painstaking about it. You know, I just do it. So yes, I'm very fast.
Well, but you must have an issue. I mean, you must, you know, be a person who could have been a career criminal if you hadn't taken to dog rescuing. You know, because your mind seems to spin off these really elaborate plots that have a lot of machinery involved in them. I mean, the plot
would be a lot more successful as a criminal, I think.
I don't think you'd be more successful. You might be in jail.
Actually, I wouldn't be successful. I'd be afraid. I wouldn't have the guts to pull it off. It's easy when you write it. But
I'm sure it is. I wouldn't really want to read prison literature by you. I have to say, in Bark of Night, if you actually killed off 18 people yourself, that'd be tough.
Is that how many die in a book?
I think so. I don't want to spoil the plot for people who haven't read it, but it does take 18 deaths as part of the mechanism for making the
whole
plot
nobody
work.
Cares. If I were to hurt a dog's paw, I would get 1,000 email protests. But I could kill as many people as I want, and nobody cares. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well, what I find fascinating is that, well, Andy Carpenter, you've set him up in an ideal position, which is in the first book, he discovered his father was a crook, essentially, and left him a lot of money.
Right.
So that he can be a lawyer when he feels like it, but mostly he doesn't feel like it.
Right. I was lucky, actually. I blundered into that.
But it was a great device.
Yeah. I was very, very lucky. I actually, his father was a lawyer and not a crook, but he got certain money dishonorably.
Right.
And when it came to the second book, I thought I should have Andy give the money back. But there was sort of no one to give it back to.
Right.
So then I thought I'd have fun with it, with Andy trying to pick charities. I could have some fun with it. And that's why he still has the money, right? So I blundered into it. And it worked fine, because now Andy has, like you say, has the ability to choose and do whatever he wants.
Well, not only does he get to choose cases, but in fact he has started a charity. He's operating a rescue facility for dogs, and he's hired people. He gets people come into his life, and then he's able to use them in useful ways.
Right.
And he also can support the policeman and the newspaper guy, who apparently have not yet bought themselves a drink or a burger.
Exactly.
But they too are extremely useful, because Andy is a lawyer. He still can't actually arrest people, so he needs Pete, the police guy, to be part of the teamwork in solving his crimes.
And Pete's reluctant about it, but always helps.
And in fact, in one case, Pete was actually a suspect in the murder case.
Yes, I've had a few of Andy's associates be on trial. I think I've exhausted that.
Well, probably only once is, you know, a reasonable...
Well, his wife...
Right, Laurie.
Right, his friend Sam, who's his cyber guy, Pete, and then Andy's original client in the first book, who he didn't know at the time, Willie Miller. He was, of course, in the first book, he was on trial, so there's four of them. I think that's enough.
So it's really dangerous to be around.
Yeah, it really is.
But somehow or other, he always perseveres. I thought for a while there, too, you know, you couldn't quite decide what to do with Andy's romantic life. I mean, he and Laurie have a thing, and then Laurie breaks up with him and goes to Wisconsin because she wants to be chief of police back in the...
That was her hometown, right?
Right. And then, you know, so it looked like they were going to be split for good, and then suddenly he goes to Wisconsin, and then she comes back, and now they're married, and now they've adopted a child. And so did you just sort of blunder your way through all that?
Literally every step of the way, I knew what was going to happen when I typed it. Like, the book four... which is sort of one of my favorites because it's about football. It's called Sudden Death. And the backstory throughout is whether or not Lori's going to go back to her hometown. She still loves Andy, but she wants this, you know. And they go for a walk near the end of the book, and she tells him what she's going to do. And I honestly didn't know until I typed it what she was going to do. So it just, yes, I blundered into that. And then it gave me an excuse to go to Wisconsin with the next book.
That's very true. Once out of New Jersey.
Right, once.
I have found, you know, the evolution of Andy and the characters. And of course, when you're writing a long series, you develop an ensemble cast. And then you have to worry about bringing them forward because people start to complain if they're missing.
Yes. The toughest part for me is reintroducing them, right? I mean, I want every book to be a standalone in that, you know, I don't expect somebody to go back 19 books necessarily and start with open and shut. But, you know, so I have to write it so that, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of authors who have the same thing, but I have to write it so that people will learn who these characters are, but longtime readers won't be bored to death by the reintroduction. So that's a little tough.
It's a very difficult balancing act. I always think about, you know, Kinsey Millhone and her little black dress and her, you know, Sue had a whole little thing she did for her detective in the Alphabet series, so it was just enough, you know, that people could wander in it, like ours for whatever. And then the hard part, I think, is if you have somebody who's in jeopardy in one book, somebody close to Andy who's going to reappear, if they read any subsequent book, then the suspense of that person being in jeopardy necessarily goes
away. If they then go back, I mean, to read the book. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So there are some series where if you don't read the first book, you'll never get the same the same suspense if you later go to it. You can pick up later books sometimes, but I think it's very hard to skip the first book in the long series.
Right.
Like Willy, for example.
Exactly. You know, Willy's the perfect example.
But if you're reading Bark of Night, there's Willy, you know, running this thing and all. You would know that whatever was up for Willy in book one
you know
was
he's
resolved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I do think that's a real challenge.
Right. Well, but I can't help that. I mean, you know, there's no solution to what you just said.
There is no solution. And I think readers bring what we call the willing suspension of disbelief to that. But the one person you also always have to bring forward, one person, one character, is Tara.
Yes.
She's going to be the longest live
She's
golden retriever
never died.
In history.
Trust me. I've honestly have answered 100 emails and wound up having to write an article for the publisher promising that nothing bad will ever happen to her.
So she's going to be 29 with an arthritic hip?
Well, she was, in 2002, for Open and Shut, she was 9, and now she's 7.
Excellent.
So she's hanging in pretty well.
She's doing really well.
Yes.
Right. So what about, I thought it was interesting that in Bark of Night, their adopted son is off to camp, which is sort of a useful thing to do
if
his parents are going to be. But in the end, he plays a really, which we can't mention, a critical role in the book, and I thought, well, yes, he does. It's a conversation with Andy and his son
that reveals
to Andy, you know, what actually is going on in the book. And I thought that was really nice because you kept the kid off stage, and then all of a sudden he comes storming in with this little part.
But it's nice to have him off stage because otherwise you have to compensate for him. You know, they can't just run out of the house and do stuff if, you know, the kid's there. So I send them out a lot of sleepovers.
You do.
And sending him to camp was made it much easier.
And he'll grow up maybe faster than
Tara. I hope so, yeah.
And see how it works.
The opposite will be true for him.
So you've also written a number of standalones that are much more pure thriller than Andy's cases. What inspired you to start those?
Just the fact that I was writing one Andy a year at the time, and it takes me 6 weeks or so to write it, so it left me some free time. So I wrote standalones. I wrote about 7 of them. And then I made one into a series, which I wrote 3 books in that series. And now I'm stopping that. I'm doing a new series in March.
You are?
Yes. It's actually, I just signed a 6-book deal, if you can believe that, for over 2 years. Each year there'll be 2 Andys, and there'll be a third, there'll be a new series, which is a spinoff of an Andy. I introduce a new character in the Christmas Andy coming up, and he, Marcus and Laurie form an investigative team because Andy doesn't like to work so much, so they need other work. And they're called the K-Team because the guy was a canine cop and his dog, and they formed the K-Team, and that'll be the first, that'll be the beginning of a new series.
Well, that sounds like fun. Well, the Christmas books, are they shorter? They're more, I thought,
no, I mean, a little
not
bit,
really.
A little bit, actually. Not much, but a little bit.
So moving to Maine has given you even more free time.
I have plenty of free time. I really do. I mean, I have plenty of free time. But, of course, football season's coming up. And
That's true.
Not exactly.
But, you know, you always sort of give me this air of not really enjoying this, but the truth is you actually do, or you wouldn't have voluntarily opened a vein and signed up for 6 more books. Plus, you have to support the dogs.
I think it's that Dorothy Parker quote, I don't hate writing, but she hates writing, but she loves having written, you know? So, like, during the process, I complain all the time, and, you know, I mean, a lot of my friends are retired, and, you know, and I'm working, right? But when a book comes out, I like it. I mean, if I like the book. And lately, I have. That wasn't always the case, but lately, I have. This book,
actually. Do you feel like you've improved as a writer?
Probably not. Probably the plots are better, or at least more intricate. But no, I don't think so.
No, I disagree. I think,
oh, good.
I think
I'm glad.
You've always had a gift for the quip, you know, which not everybody has. I mean,
right, but that's been consistent. That's what I like the best. I mean, you know, that's what I like.
I think so too, but I think the earlier books maybe depended more on the humor and less on the plot. And now I think this new book, Bark of Night, you've got a really original idea, very well thought out and very well brought off, I think.
I think the plots are probably better. I have a tendency to make them too big, in that you know, he's a Paterson, New Jersey lawyer, and he winds up saving the world all the time. You know, I mean, it's, so I need to make them some smaller. And I do that actually in the next book, the Christmas book coming up. So, yeah, I think the humor's probably been consistent. Maybe if I went back and read the earlier books, I'd be horrified. I don't know.
No, I didn't think so. I mean, after all, I've stuck with you, so clearly yeah. I wasn't horrified at the very beginning. Now, I've always enjoyed them. You're very good at characterization. You've always had, you know, a lot of humor, and you're clever. But I think the plots have gotten to be, maybe the word is, better engineered.
Probably.
You know, less dependent upon pure happenstance, and maybe with more deliberation.
I guess. I mean, it's by far the hardest part for me, because I can't think ahead, so it just evolves by itself. So the only tough part for me is what should come next, what should be in the next three pages, right? And it's...
But this is where I come back to my point that you probably actually could have been a career criminal.
Yeah,
since you think that yeah. way. Well, we're going to go forth and talk about your book to your adoring fans and whichever dogs have arrived. So thank you very much for a chance to talk to you.
Thank you.